Hello and welcome to Network Europe with me, Chris Moore. In this edition, we go to Turkey, where bomb attacks have thrown the spotlight on the struggle of Kurdish separatists. The Middle East crisis has repercussions in the Czech Republic, where skinheads demand to take the fight to Israel. Delegates meet in Sweden to discuss peace and reconciliation in lawless Somalia. In Paris, an American evangelical preacher tries to get the French to sing the gospel. And we look at why surfers are flocking to the landlocked German city of Munich. All that coming up, so do stay tuned. As you probably know, Turkey has experienced a week of violence with a series of bombs exploding across the country. Weekend attacks in tourist resorts and in the larger city, Istanbul, killed 3 people and left dozens wounded, including tourists from the United Kingdom. The Kurdish Freedom Falcons, a group fighting for Kurdish rights, claim responsibility, calling for foreign tourists to stay away from Turkey. The attacks have once again put the spotlight on the 20-year struggle between Kurdish separatists fighting for an independent homeland and Turkey's national government. Adding to the pressure is Turkey's campaign for admission to the European Union. As Deutsche Welle's Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the latest bombings are fueling fears of a major escalation in the conflict.
Security forces across Turkey are now on high alert, following this week's attacks in Istanbul and the coastal resorts of Marmaris and Antalya. Here at Taksim Square, in the heart of Istanbul, with its lively bars and shops, heavily armed police are looking on. Speaking to people here, one detects a sense of anger and fear. This woman's view reflects the sentiments of many.
I feel insecure because I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to come out. I'm scared.
Not far from Taksim Square is the Kurtuluş district, one of the poorest neighbourhoods of the city. Few tourists, if any, come here. It's a predominantly Kurdish district. And it's from places like this that members of the Kurdish Liberation Falcons, or TAK, come from. This group that claim responsibility for the attacks draws mainly from the urban poor, say intelligence sources. Many migrated here from the predominantly Kurdish southeast of Turkey during the years of war between the Kurdish separatists, the PKK, and Turkish authorities. It remains unclear what links the Kurdish militant group TAK has with the PKK. But the group has called for the release of Abdullah Öcalan, the PKK leader, who is serving a life sentence in jail. This week's attacks are the latest in a wave of similar bombings by TAK last year, indiscriminately targeting tourist resorts and urban centres like Istanbul. Speaking to Kurds here, like street seller Hasan, there appears to be little support for their tactics.
My brother-in-law was injured in one attack. He lost his leg while waiting for a bus here in Istanbul. Kurds are hurting Kurds. This bombing is wrong. Yes, there are problems in Turkey, but no normal person would leave a bomb in a street that could kill anyone.
Thousands of nationalists protesting at the latest funeral of a soldier killed by the PKK. TAK bombings come at the same time as the PKK is stepping up its operations in southeast Turkey. Dozens of Turkish soldiers have lost their lives in the last few months. And with every funeral, nationalist fervour is on the rise, increasing pressure on the government to act. This week, General Yaşar Bükkanat became the new chief of staff. Bükkanat has the reputation of being a hawk compared to his predecessor. His first address as chief of staff on Monday was tough. He promised an uncompromising approach.
Since its founding, Turkey has never witnessed so many threats to its existence as it does now. Separatist terror and other attempts planned to destroy the unitary system of government in Turkey. We are obliged to carefully monitor separatist activities targeting the indivisible unity of our country. We are also obliged to take all necessary measures against them.
A Turkish fighter jet taking off from a base in southeast Turkey. In the last few weeks, there's been a build-up of Turkish forces in the region. According to unconfirmed reports, Turkish forces attacked PKK bases in neighboring northern Iraq. Further operations are expected against the PKK. Under pressure from the European Union, the government has introduced a series of legal reforms aimed at alleviating Kurdish grievances. But with upcoming elections next year and rising nationalist fervour gripping the country, the government seems to be giving the army a free hand. Dilek Korban of the Turkish think tank TESEF says Turkey is on the verge of falling into a new spiral of violence.
I honestly think that the government has not really yet come to terms with the extent of the problem. There's still this sort of understanding that this was a terror-related incident and just the consequences of the fight with terror. You know, I mean, what needs to be done really is that the government, not just the government, but the government, state and the public will come to terms with the problem, will acknowledge it, and we will all start thinking about, collectively, thinking about ways to solve this.
Voices like Korban's, though, are increasingly blowing in the wind. When the government came to power 4 years ago, the PKK had declared a ceasefire, and a new administration, under pressure from the European Union, was promising a new era of Kurdish reform and long-term peace. Those days seem long gone. Turkish cities are bracing themselves for further bombings, while the military is preparing for what could be a major crackdown. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
Elsewhere this week, over two dozen Czech neo-Nazis were arrested in Prague after a protest outside the city's Israeli embassy. Most of them were members of a group called National Resistance, who recently asked the Czech president to be allowed to join foreign armed forces to take part in a war against Israel. But just how strong is the neo-Nazi movement in the Czech Republic? That's a question Radio Prague's Dieter Asidu put to extremism expert Miroslav Mareš.
The strongest ultra-right movement were in the Czech Republic in the 90s. However, at the beginning of the new millennium, the Czech police and Czech governmental offices provided the offensive against this neo-Nazi movement, and now it's a new phenomena of the people. They are more active in illegal activities, and they are people with more experiences with the fight against the system. The national resistance, so-called Národní odpor, is the most important and biggest neo-Nazi organization in the Czech Republic. And this organization has cells in various cities of the Czech Republic. This organization is oriented to the militant demonstrations, to the neo-Nazi concerts of the so-called white power music and other militant activities.
And do you know how many people are in this movement?
About 500 people, I think. The Czech neo-Nazi movement is bigger than this organization. I think that inside of the Czech neo-Nazi movement is active, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 people.
Czech television has reported that one of the detained men was a police officer from the Prague 10 district. Now, the police have often been criticized for being too lax or too accepting of neo-Nazis, and there have been cases when someone clearly did the Nazi salute but was not detained. Do you agree with this criticism? Would you say that the authorities have not been doing enough to clamp down on the neo-Nazi movement?
I'm not agree. I think that this man was not a member of the state police, it was only a member of the city police. I think that the Czech state police is anti-Nazi oriented. Maybe that some sympathizers are inside the Czech police. However, I think it's not in the Czech security bodies.
How common are clashes between neo-Nazis and foreigners or members of the Jewish community here? And what form do they take?
There are both verbal as physical attacks. There exist also some books or materials to the terrorist fight against ethnic minorities and against the enemies from the ultra-left side of political spectrum within the Czech neo-Nazi movement. Also, there exist some paramilitary camps of national resistance in the Czech Republic. However, up to this time, are not significant terrorist activities in the Czech Republic.
And what kind of people join the neo-Nazi movement here?
There are teenagers and people between 20 to the 26 years. And the social basis is very different. There are people with university education. However, the biggest part of the Czech neo-Nazis are people from working class, from unemployment people, and etc.
Czech extremism expert Miroslav Mareš talking to Dieter Asidu of Radio Prague. And congratulations to Radio Prague, which this week marked the 70th anniversary of its first broadcast. Sweden has played host to a meeting of the International Contact Group on Somalia, established to support peace and reconciliation efforts in the lawless African nation. The European delegates were from Sweden, Norway, Italy and the United Kingdom, Radio Sweden's Bill Schiller reports.
For years, the world seemed to ignore the military and political battles of the clans and rival groups in Somalia, created from former British and Italian colonies on the Horn of Africa. An earlier intervention of the United States ended with a hasty retreat, with warlords ordering the dragging of dead American soldiers through the streets, a bloody humiliation photographed and spread around the globe. But there have been renewed interests in trying to find a settlement and see the creation of a viable government in Somalia responding to the needs of the entire population. This interest has been fueled by fears of a country without a government becoming the perfect hiding place for terrorists and other violence-happy fanatics. Worries that the conflict could spread over Somalia's borders, that the river of illegal and uncontrolled arms shipments flowing into the country despite the UN weapons embargo could continue to swell. The international group has experienced waves of high hopes and dismal despair, with each peace agreement reached in Somalia only to be broken again, in bloody battles also claiming civilian lives and compounding misery. Despair as well over continued reports of human rights violations, suffering populations, and refugees fleeing to neighboring African countries and to faraway destinations such as Sweden and the rest of Europe. At this contact group meeting at the Swedish Foreign Ministry, representatives from Finland as the rotating president of the European Union, the African Union, the League of Arab States, the United Nations, as well as Norway, Italy, Britain, and the United States. The meeting has also called on all actors in the region to refrain from military actions. The meeting also hopes that a promise of high-level international economic assistance can encourage all parties to make peace. It notes that there have been some improvements with humanitarian access through the international airports and harbors. The Stockholm session supports a continued dialogue of the rival power factors in Somalia today, the transitional federal institutions and the Union of Islamic Courts, the UIC, which has taken control of the capital of Mogadishu. The session calls for the return of the transitional institutions back to the capital and the lifting of the UIC's ban on civil society organizations, which has cut off assistance to local communities. Swedish State Secretary of International Development, Annika Söder, explains what she hopes can be accomplished by this meeting.
Send a strong signal from the international community to the talks between the UIC and the transitional institutions that will hopefully take place later this week. Send a strong signal that in order for the Somali people to eventually get a decent life, they will have to agree on how to run the country and how to find a way to share power in the federation as such and also at the regional levels.
A future donor conference organized by Italy and Sweden to be held in Rome, promising money only when it looks like there's a realistic possibility of supporting the government. When will this take place, do you think?
We've been very optimistic for a long time now. Unfortunately, the situation is now very blurred and it's difficult to tell when. But it's important to send a signal to the Somalis and to the parties in the conflict of Somalia that we are ready to contribute as soon as it will be possible through a political solution.
A civil war almost ignored by the world for many years. Who's concerned now and what's happening with Somalia?
There is a big engagement in the Security Council and many of the members of the Security Council are here today. Also the region itself on the Horn of Africa and the African Union, they're all engaged and they're here to discuss how to solve the problem. And I believe that one reason for this is that there are many that are worried about the risk for a regional conflict.
Already an international arms embargo, yet weapons are still coming into the country, human rights violations continue. What can be done in the meantime before such a donors conference, before such a stable government is created?
Unfortunately, security would not allow any monitoring of the arms embargo. So what we can do is send very strong signals about how to proceed politically in order to have a stop when it comes to interference from other parties.
Any disagreement in this international collection of nations, the United States or Britain or the UN, anyone saying let's move fast, let's not rush too quickly? What kind of harmony is there in this international group meeting here in Stockholm?
There are so many different interests that it would be very strange if we had full harmony, and that would not be productive either, I must say. So I think that we have very good discussions, and even if there's not always a meeting of minds, it's useful, and in the end it will benefit Somalia.
State Secretary Annika Söder and her colleagues at the International Meeting on Somalia agree that the volatile situation on the Horn of Africa cannot be settled by sending in foreign troops, African or any other, since this could ignite an already volatile crisis. They conclude that the only thing to do is to encourage a continuing dialogue, with further international sessions aimed at putting more pressure on all sides in the conflict area. The Stockholm meeting has followed an earlier session in Brussels, with another gathering planned in the near future, this time as close as possible to Somalia itself. In the meantime, relief work is being carried out by non-government organizations in Somalia, supported by a number of Western countries, including Sweden. Doctors, nurses, foreign aid workers, but all on a small scale, greatly hindered by the lack of security or future guarantees, working in a unique situation where no national government exists and may not exist for a long time to come.
That was Radio Sweden's Bill Schiller. In France, the traditional church is struggling to attract new blood, but evangelical and charismatic churches, with their emphasis on miracles, joyful gospel singing, adult immersions and speaking in tongues, are rapidly gaining ground. An American preacher recently finished a week of crusading here in Paris, hoping to swell the ranks of France's 500,000 evangelical followers. And with audiences of more than 4,000 people a day, his meetings were unprecedented both in size and in style. Radio France International's Alison Hurd reports.
Jesus said, Satan comes to kill and steal.
Satan ne vient que pour voler, tuer et détruire.
Jesus is the healer.
You'd be forgiven for thinking we're in the US Bible Belt, but this is southeast Paris, in front of the Chateau of Vincennes, and the US preacher T.L. Osborne is working his magic on a congregation of around 5,000 people.
I command the sicknesses to die.
He promises they'll see miracles, proof that Jesus is alive. The sick who've come along will be healed if only they believe. With their arms in the air and eyes closed, the crowd of mainly black Africans, West Indians and gypsies is captivated by the Reverend Osborne as he guides the mass prayer session.
Let my cripples walk.
When Maimouna Mitaye hobbles slowly onto the stage, leaving her wheelchair behind, the crowd hits fever pitch. One evening I fell down and was in a coma for 3 weeks. When I woke up, I was paralyzed on my left side. I haven't walked unaided since. I've been in a wheelchair since 2001, but God has saved me. My little girl came here with me and said, Mum, tonight you're going to walk. I'm so happy. I feel like a new person. For 2 hours, T.L. Osborne gives a very American show based on music and miracles and the repetition of a very simple message. Jesus loves you, he's alive through his miracles, believe and spread the word. The 84-year-old, whose ginger wig and facelift give him a youthful air, has taken his message around the world for the last 60 years. But he hadn't been to France since 1960 and never before for a meeting on this scale. Francis Pfister, pastor at the Pentecostal church in Paris's 9th arrondissement, says it's a miracle he's here today.
That is a miracle for us in France. We have asked to make an outreach outside in open air. And you see, this has never happened. And with some pastor, we thought it was impossible because, you know, the evangelical, we were a long time a minority and they were taxing us as sects. But now something is changing, and in Montreuil we had every night 4,000 people, which is for France a very big crowd, and few evangelists have seen that.
T.L. Osborne was invited by a group of evangelical preachers from the Paris region, including Tunde Johnson, who came over as a missionary from Nigeria 15 years ago.
Actually, we think that France need evangelism and they need God. That's why we invited Dr. T.L. Osborne. He's a prophet, he's not a miracle worker. He's a voice to preach to people who are sick or who have some kinds of problems to hear the word of God.
Francis Pfister claims the need for evangelizing in France is greater than ever.
Last November, we were on the verge of a civil war because we have in our city of Paris, thousands of cars were burned out from young people. What has appeared in that moment? That many young people they are so destroyed, so desperate, they don't know what is right, what is wrong, and the gospel is a better healing method. As T.R. Osborne said, a government can make laws to punish bad people, government cannot make laws to make people good.
An exhausted, if smiling, Osborne comes off the stage after more than 2 hours. Before being whisked away in a large black saloon car, I asked him how it had gone.
Wonderful. Multitude, miracles, joy, rejoicing, that's what was in the Bible. I'm sorry that the government didn't let us continue.
Do you know what those reasons might be?
Someone told me they're afraid of the riots, torching cars. They don't want that to happen. Well, the Christians don't do that. It's the Muslims that did that. I'm sorry they did that.
That opinion has been boosted by much coverage of last year's riots in the US media, which emphasized religious differences more than social inequalities. Whether the Osborne ministry seeks to convert Muslims or simply bolster evangelical fervour among Christians to counter Islam isn't clear. What is sure is that as the faithful clamoured to touch the evangelist as he sped away, many more souls were ready to go out and preach the gospel, convinced that the true and only path to salvation is via Jesus Christ. For RFI, I'm Alison Hurd.
And finally to the German city of Munich. Now ask any local and they'll tell you that they have great beer, and that with a national high of sunny days, their home state Bavaria is Germany's California. Sure, Munich doesn't have a Pacific Ocean or a Malibu beach on its doorstep, but that's not stopping intrepid locals from going surfing, albeit on a local river called the Eisbach. Deutsche Welle's Guy Degen has more.
Parking my car in downtown Munich near the genteel Englischer Garten, the first evidence of surfing I spot is a discarded wrapper from a stick of Australian surfing wax. Ahead of me, a couple of black wetsuited surfers clutching their surfboards jog across the main road. They dart past onlookers leaning over a bridge and duck through bushes to the banks of the Eisbach. Following them confirmed all the stories I'd heard about the possibility of surfing in Munich. The power and sheer volume of water from the Eisbach as it emerges from an underground tunnel produces a small wave about 12 metres wide and with a clean face, just like the real thing in the ocean. Wading up in the frigid knee-high water to talk to some of the surfers, I meet Rolf, who's been surfing the Eisbach for the past 4 years.
When you compare it to the ocean, everything happens much faster than on the ocean, because you have always to do radical turns. You don't have to do some curves. You have really turns like 180 degrees within a few seconds. The water comes out of the tunnel with 5 meters per second, which is like 36 kilometers per hour. So it's okay. It's not too slow.
Only one person can surf at a time. And as it's not possible to paddle upriver to the crest of the wave, Rolf says locals have worked out a number of methods to catch this wave. Many sit on the riverbank, set their feet correctly on the surfboard, and then stand up and slide down the face of the wave. Others simply throw the board ahead into the water and jump on. Under the gaze of about 20 onlookers, I watch Rolf take off.
I just try to stay as long as I'm able to.
Okay. Now, Rolf is actually sitting down beside on a piece of wood. He's getting his balance and his feet positioned right on the surfboard, and he's just taken off. He's gone right across to the other side of the bank, cut back, and he's cutting back hard. Oh, bit of a wipeout there. Only about 3 or 4 seconds on that wave.
Rolf's wipeout wasn't too bad, and within a minute he's back waiting for his turn. But surfing here is not without its hazards, as the riverbed in front of the wave is only just below the surface.
Yeah, I cut some fin cut, like here. I got it from here, and here on the back, I hit the rocks behind the wave. It happens any time.
And while Rolf was more than happy to speak with me, other surfers weren't very keen. Some said the Eisbach wave was too well known, perhaps a touch of protective localism. But among the crowd watching is Adam Brown, an Australian surfing instructor from the East Coast surf mecca of Byron Bay. While travelling in Germany, Adam thought he'd check out this wave for himself.
Yeah, it looks pretty fun. Like, this guy's given it a belt, but it's honestly better than I thought.
Now, of course, this is not the ocean, and compared to waves that you would normally surf in Australia, from your perspective, what's the difference in surfing here?
Well, because it's quite fast, there's a little hole in front of the wave. It actually gives a real feeling for a much faster wave, something normally that would be bigger. So, yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of potential for a small wave. It really does suck really quickly, so that would give it the same sort of speed as a wave, probably like an extra half a foot higher or something. So it's got a lot of potential, honestly.
And in terms of degree of difficulty, how would you rate it?
Well, I haven't had a crack at it yet, but it doesn't look hard at all. Honestly, you can come from either side. You can start with your feet on the board before you even push off the wall. And yeah, very easy, I reckon. Anyone could have a go at it.
Leaving Adam to work out how he might rustle up a board, I noticed small signs pinned on trees advertising surfboards for sale, much the same as you'd see near any surfing beach break. However, beside these are large signs clearly stating that it's forbidden to surf this wave. So what do officials think of surfers blatantly breaking the law? Rainer Herzog is head of the Garden Department of the Bavarian Administration for State Palaces, Gardens and Lakes. He says while surfing may be attractive for tourists, it's definitely forbidden under the law in the grounds of the Englischer Garten.
Bisher haben wir noch von Strafen abgesehen, aber man weiß nicht, wenn da irgendjemand ernsthaft verunglückt.
So far we've refrained from fines, but if there is a serious accident, then it's going to become a problem, so it's not allowed. The city of Munich has laws for its parks, but in the Englischer Garten these don't apply because it's property of the state of Bavaria. If it's only an administrative offence like surfing on the ice park, then there are no laws regulating that, and the police don't do anything.
On any given day, at least a dozen surfers are testing their skills on the ice park wave in the Englischer Garten. And if you ask the right local, they may let you in on some other good surf spots nearby. Such as the popularity of river surfing in Bavaria, that special river surfboards are being produced by a shaper in Munich and sold in local surf shops. Munich's city river wave on the ice park may not be up there with Pipeline in Hawaii or Bell's Beach in Australia, but for many a landlocked surfer in Germany, it's the next best thing. Guy Deegan, Deutsche Welle Radio, Munich.
That's just about it from this week's programme, except, of course, for our Network Europe quiz. You've been hearing about having a good time in Munich, but apart from surfing down the river, the Bavarian city is, of course, also well known for its extremely popular annual beer festival. I'd simply like you to tell me what that annual beer festival is called. You can send your answers by email to contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. Network Europe receives funding from the European Union and is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Slovak Radio, Radio Prague, Radio Slovenia International, Radio Ukraine and Deutsche Welle. Leaving you with some music now, and as we've been talking about beer in Munich, here's Berg Stauber from the Beer Festival compilation album. On behalf of all our contributors, from me, Chris Moore, it's goodbye and thanks for tuning in.